I'm Doris Edmond. I've had all sorts of teaching jobs, so I won't try to tell you my life story since it's so many years. But the last job I had, so-called, just before I retired for good, was at California Lutheran College, where I taught early childhood curriculum and research. I did that for 4 years. And when we were in Rock Island, I started the lab school there that's known as Red Shoes, where we taught four-year-olds taught also teachers, that is, the trained teachers there. Then when we moved to California, we're at California Lutheran College now, and when we moved to California, I wrote a series of idea files called Let's Begin. Some of you may be familiar with that. They used to have them in the bookstore, but it's been over 10 years ago, so they've stopped publishing them. And there's still a songbook there that I did. Today we're going to talk about parenting self-worth. Since there are no perfect parents, and it's not really a very good idea to try to be one, the best we can hope to be are wise and positive parents. If we feel good about ourselves and have confidence in our own parenting skills, chances are our children too will have positive self-images. We might discuss some of the pitfalls of perfectionism in parents. The closest a person can come to perfection, I've heard it said, is to admit their mistakes. A member of our Holden staff was telling me that on her way up here, she stopped with friends along the way, and she thought she'd be helpful, so she offered to set the table. Knowing the lady there was very particular, she did it with a great deal of care. When the lady of the house came out and looked, she said, "Oh dear, let me correct you on this." And she said, "You must put the salad plates here instead of there." And it was a small thing, but it just left her completely deflated, and she thought to herself, "Gee, I feel sorry for her kids. If that's the kind of perfection she insists on." All parents, of course, want their children to be self-confident after they grow up and leave home. But some parents prefer to keep their children meek and submissive in the meantime. They reveal an almost compulsive need to belittle their children in various ways. They tell visitors, for example, while their children are present, about the children's shortcomings. How often have you heard friends or neighbors thoughtlessly make the remarks such as this? "Now, let me do that. You're such a clumsy one, you'll probably break it." "Oh no, don't put the fork on the right side. Put it on the left side. You're old enough to know left from right." And then they'll say, "Yes, we took Jerry to the lake yesterday, but he wouldn't even try to learn to swim. And there stands Jerry. He really is nothing but a scaredy cat." The most valuable freedom we can give any child is the freedom to make mistakes. It's the parent who has always insisted on perfection in himself who is most prone to expect perfection in his child. Now, God accepts us all the way we are, and even in spite of our mistakes. But it behooves us also then to accept our children on the same basis. They must know we love them because of themselves, not because of their performance. Only then can we live with each other in joy and grace? And husbands and wives must set the pattern. If one is constantly criticizing the other one then has to figure out some way they can criticize him or her. So we as parents set the pattern for our children, and we must help them respect themselves. Be glad they're who they are. Then they'll be free to love and respect others. And of course, their opinion of themselves depends on the people around them, what other people reflect to them. If the general home atmosphere is one of acceptance, where the members tend to build each other up rather than tear them down, no one will have to be on the defensive, but they'll tend to stand up for each other, affirm each other when they make mistakes. Dr. Sisney was our school psychologist in Oklahoma City, and I loved to hear his lectures, even though he would tell some of the same stories over and over, but I needed to hear those things over and over again. And one that I especially appreciated was when he described one little boy who was sent to him, and he said he came in throwing stuff at him, and so he had him draw a picture of the parent he thought might be at the bottom of this behavior. So he asked the little boy to draw a picture of his mother. She drew a picture of his mother facing the wall. And Dr. Sisney said, why did you face her to the wall? And he said, if I'd turned her around, it would have been yakety, yakety, yak. Are we willing to forgive and forget, or do we harp a lot? Just bringing up things, mistakes that they made yesterday, maybe, or last year. If we say anything to cause a child to think less of himself, we are destroying something very precious within that child. Let's be quick to express gratitude. And when it's necessary to correct our child, we need to watch the tone of our voice. I always tried, and I didn't always remember, but if I were going to correct a child, I'd always try to say something positive about him first. You're doing a good job. Now let's try to do this. Courtesy should be a matter of habit if we expect our children to be courteous. Constant griping is really telling them, I am ungrateful. Larry was 4 in my pre-kindergarten class. He was big and handsome boy, but showed considerable pent-up belligerence. He would come in with his fists clenched on Monday mornings, especially, I noticed. And I knew his parents seemed to be very intelligent. They were both teachers, and they both had master's degrees. But Larry was the only child in the family, and would often tell me when he came to school, boy, I got to be careful about these shoes. They're brand new. My mom says, don't get your pants dirty today. This clued me into a suspicion that he was a victim of the perfect parent. So I asked his parents for a conference, and I found that they had a brand new house with a freshly seeded lawn where Larry was not allowed to play. Both parents admitted being preoccupied with fixing up the house, and they wanted so much to do a good job with Larry. They said, after all, he's all we've got. But they weren't enjoying him. His father said, I let him come down in the shop and watch me make cabinets. He didn't say anything about giving Larry a hammer to let him get rid of some of his frustrations. I asked them,
Do you ever allow Larry to make a decision for himself? I said, 4-year-old, what kind of decision could he make? And I said, well, do you let him pick out what he's going to wear to school? I was thinking of these clean pants and these brand new shoes. And she says, oh no, I lay his clothes out for him the night before so he knows exactly what to wear. And when we send him off to school, his father said, I always say, now Larry, you be a good boy today. I said, do me a favor. Tell Larry, have some fun today, Larry. His parents had prayer time with him each night, and it sounded as though Daddy was the one who conducted this hour. And one night he said, does God love me even when I'm naughty? And then quickly he added, Mrs. Edmund says he does. And so that, here again, Larry was figuring that his love depended on how he behaved, not because he was Larry. Well, after talking to them, they promised they would take the pressure off, and they'd make a time to play with him and enjoy him. And you know, it wasn't long until I saw a complete change in him. Those little fists weren't clenched on Monday mornings anymore. And our pastor, who lived just a few houses from them, said, what in the world has happened to Larry? We just love to have him come over now. It used to be that he was ready to pick a fight, regardless. And but here again, we have to remember that a child has to be a child. And there are certain drives that they need to satisfy. Some kids are more active and physical than others. Some are perfectly satisfied to sit and read a book or play a game. But Larry had to get out and use his muscles. I don't know what happened to Larry, but I imagine he did play football and get into athletics in college. Then, of course, there is the martyr parent syndrome, which usually results from a mother trying to be the perfect mother by waiting hand and foot on the child. Mary Jane had that kind of a mother. And when they first came to enroll Mary Jane at the lab school, her mother said, it's either you or a psychiatrist. And I said, why do you say that? Well, she said she has tantrums all the time. I said, what sets off a tantrum? Well, for instance, if I give her a pink spoon instead of a green spoon at lunch for her soup, she has this tantrum. And I said, why isn't she setting the table? Now that hadn't occurred to her. She hadn't allowed to, Mary Jane, she was just a little 4-year-old, she hadn't allowed to do anything for herself. And she had a tremendous leadership drive. I noticed that she hadn't been in school more than a day. She was cleaning up the tables and she was helping everybody else and she was making suggestions. And this drive had to be satisfied just as much as Larry's drive for physical activity had to be satisfied, or they just blow their tops. But anyway, as soon as her mother started, I said, let Mary Jane help any way you can think of at home. Dust, scrub, run the sweeper if she's able to, carry out the trash. Let her be your helper. And she took my suggestions, and it wasn't long till she was calling me. Mary Jane, stop biting her fingernails. We only had one tantrum this week. And at the very end of the year, she said, I just got to tell you this. But I took Mary Jane to the roundup for first grade. And she told me that I should stand over in the corner because, after all, she was the one who's being registered, not me. So she asked for her insurance money, which I gave her, and she said I stood back. She's the only kid in line who didn't have a mother. But that was Mary Jane. She wanted to take charge. Of course, there are no perfect parents. Just the act of admitting that to ourselves and to our children will make us better parents. The freedom to make mistakes makes any home a more effective learning lab. To learn, we must not be afraid to take risks. To risk a great deal means to make a good many mistakes. Being able to admit these mistakes and feel the love and forgiveness of those around us helps each one of us to be more accepting and more forgiving. And that's about as perfect as we can get. Then we have the Phi Beta Kappa parent who just isn't happy with the average child. They must be super bright in order to save face with the neighbors and the other relatives that we always check with. It seems that unless they bring home straight A's, they do not satisfy such parents. One young parent was telling about her father. And she said, you know, we had a really important test. And I got the highest grade in this class. It was a 97. And I could hardly wait to show my dad. And when I showed it to him, he said, how about those other 3 points? And she said, do you know that I have almost caught myself doing the same thing to my children? You see, we usually pattern our parenting after our parents. We find this in child abuse all the time. It's the child who was abused who becomes the abusing parent. It's the only style they know. How many of you read the story about Dibs? I recommend it wholeheartedly. It's an old classic as far as psychology is concerned and child rearing. It was recommended to me when I was volunteering to help in the state hospital with preschool children who were completely autistic. And the director thought that if I read that, it would really help me understand. Because Dibs turned out to be autistic. And his parents realized, his mother was an MD, and his father was an engineer. And all of a sudden, Dibs stopped talking. So they became real worried and got a therapist by the name of Virginia Axline to see what she could do with him. So she worked with him day after day after day. And she had found out that his parents, when he started to talk, his parents put down everything he said. They said, well, how stupid, can't you say it better than that? And this is what he heard over and over again. He wasn't stupid. He was smart enough to finally just shut up, not say anything. If you can't please them, you know, what's the point of saying anything? So from that time on, he became autistic. And so it was Virginia Axline's job to bring him out again, where his natural intelligence really showed up. And she found out after she finished her therapy and he began to talk as any child talks, she tested his IQ and it was 170. That's genius. But he was smart not to talk. I mean, he was showing his intelligence right there. So if you're curious about how Virginia Ashline brought him around, this book is sort of a day-to-day therapy session with Dibbs, and as he gradually came out of his shell. A number of years ago, Stanley Cooper Smith, chairman of the Department of Psychology of the University of California at Davis, did a revealing study which showed that parental acceptance combined with strictness is conspicuous in homes of parents who are getting good results. It is, however, a special kind of strictness, not to be confused with excessive reliance on punishment, which assures the child that his parents love him and are concerned for his welfare. Dr. Cooper Smith's study is focused squarely on the factor in human personality, which we have been referring to as self-esteem or self-worth. The attitude which each child has toward himself and which affects his attitude toward the outside world. The families that were interviewed, almost all of them reported that the firm rules set in their families were enforced carefully and consistently, and they found rewards more effective than punishments. Do you think it's possible for a child to develop too much self-esteem? Dr. Cooper Smith found no evidence of this. But he makes a distinction between self-confidence and vanity, arrogance, boastfulness, and excessive pride. These traits are often symptoms of low self-esteem. Hidden deeper inside the child, it is the child or adult who is unsure of his worth, who must seize every occasion to boast and behave arrogantly. Sometimes the false front, such as an adult or child erects, is designed to bolster his self-image as well as to impress other people. I wish I knew who wrote it, but I'm sure that you've all heard it or read it. Some of you may have it hanging on your wall, but it fits with what we have been saying, so I'm going to repeat it now. I think it bears repetition. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If a child lives with jealousy, he learns to feel guilty. If a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If a child lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If a child lives with fairness, he learns justice. If a child lives with security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world. This confirms a statement made by Horace Bushnell in 1888. It is to be noted, Dr. Bushnell says, that the most genuine teaching, or only genuine teaching, will be that which interprets the truth to the child's feelings by living example. No truth is really taught by words or interpreted by intellectual and logical attitudes. Truth must be lived into meaning before it can be truly known. Examples are the only sufficient commentaries. Children probably learn more about true Christian living from the attitude of love their father and mother have and for each other than anything else. If the mother and father love each other selflessly, then the children will know that they also are loved. We experience the love of God through those around us. Faith begins to grow the minute the child in the cradle realizes someone will feed them, when they are hungry. And if a mother and father naturally are considerate of each other and thoughtful about the other person and how the other person feels, they are teaching sensitivity. When they openly show appreciation, the children will catch the spirit of gratitude. Constant criticism in the home teaches children a condemning attitude toward others. They will also feel unworthy and build up a feeling of guilt without knowing why. Subtly, a value system is built up in each person. Do material things get precedence over human and spiritual values? Do the parents rejoice in a child because he beat another child in an examination? Or do they rather, along with their pleasure in their own child's accomplishment, show a concern for the child who didn't have it so easy? Parents who understand their children's differences will not hold one child up to compare another. And I think this is one of the most devastating things in any family. When one child is really bright or really a good athlete, well, why can't you be as good as your sister or your brother? And then, of course, what happens is there's a lot of resistance and resentment that's built up between siblings. The same thing can happen when parents make a big deal out of treating each child equally. And that's another perfect parent syndrome. You know, well, if he gets this, then she should have that, of equal worth, instead of taking care of each child's needs as it arises. When they feel compelled to buy something for another child just because one child needs, for instance, a new coat, then before they know it, the children are keeping score. Hey, he got a new coat. I didn't get a new coat. But the parents build that attitude into their children just by being so sure that they're going to treat each one equally. So this thing can last into adulthood and really make bitter enemies out of siblings, even after they've left the home and are married. And they start vying for the things that their parents have that they want. And if one gets a vase, then the other one has to have something of equal value. I have seen this happen, and I've talked to women that it's happened to, and said, we saw our mother doing this, and she was building this up in us. And they said, to make it worse, now she's trying to treat all the grandchildren equally. And before you know it, the grandchildren will be keeping score and say, that wasn't fair. An innate sense of humor, if possible, is possibly one of the most effective tools in fighting perfectionism. When we can laugh at our own mistakes, our children then will learn to do the same. It's one of the best ways to get rid of that accusing finger. I used to use that technique with four-year-olds. Every once in a while, I'd really goof on purpose. And then we'd laugh about it and say, oh, I really made a mistake, didn't I? And you know, when you build that in them, then they're willing to admit to their mistakes. They're not going to lie out of it. Because after all, teacher or mommy made a mistake, so it's okay to make a mistake, and we'll be honest about it. A misbehaving child is usually a discouraged child. I remember back in Oklahoma City, I was teaching a third grade until Christmas, and then they took my third grade away from me because they had too many third grade teachers and not enough second grade teachers, so they put me in the second grade.
And the second grade teachers were instructed to give me every seventh child on their class book. Well, you know what happened. Every seventh child, you know, happened to be at the bottom of the barrel. And the director said, I knew they were going to do this. There was one teacher who did it honestly. And so I had two good students in that class. I really felt sorry for them, but we had to make special arrangements for them. But I told their supervisor, you know, I think that I can deal with anyone they send me unless they send me Robert Trump. I said, I've seen so much of him out on the playground. He usually ends up with his face to the wall or on the sidelines because he's been beating up some child. And I said, I just don't think I could handle him. And she said, well, maybe you won't get it. But sure enough, here comes Robert with his little book with a great big smile. And I said, Robert, do I get you? And he said, yes. Robert had been in school for 5 years, 10 in kindergarten, and he was just in second grade. He didn't know any of his letters, he didn't know how to write his name, and he didn't know his numbers. But I had a feeling that Robert was pretty bright. And so when I decided that what Robert needed, he told me that he'd been spanked every day. When I opened up my drawer of my desk, there was a wooden paddle. And I had never seen anything like this. In Illinois, it's against the law to even spank with your hands, but a wooden paddle. So I pulled it out of the drawer. I said, what's this for? And they said, you're supposed to spank us when we're naughty. And I said, not really. Very interesting. So I put it back in the drawer. And Robert told me, he said, you know, at the end of the year, he wanted to stay in second grade. And I said, well, why in the world would you want to stay in second grade? You can do second grade work now. You're ready to go on to third grade. Won't that be fun? He says, yeah, but you're the only teacher who never spanked me. And when he came in, as my supervisor said, just take every child where they are and let them go at their own rate of speed. And that was the most wonderful thing she could have said. She says they don't have to pass any tests. And, you know, you will not be judged by the grades that your children make on standardized tests, because I know what you got. So I decided that Robert had to succeed. And Robert had a little friend who was about at the same level. And I said, now, you two boys, when I cannot see spelling words, if you get the first letter of every word right, I'm going to give you 100. And so eventually, Robert got 100. And his father came to me at the end of the school year and said, I'll never forget the day that Robert came home with 100 on his paper. He said he was a different boy at home after that. The first time he'd ever succeeded. Now, I think that's child abuse, not allowing a child to succeed at his own level. But I had a feeling that if the teachers would only understand Robert, realize that his parents were together, and then they were apart, and then they were together, and then they were apart, he must have had a horrendous home life. And every adult, as far as he was concerned, was his enemy, unless they proved differently. But that's the premise he started out with. Bernard, in Child Development and Learning, says, mere words such as brat, volunteered, ornery, stupid, I believe to start the baby on a destructive course of life. A tiny baby on a blanket on the floor while you're talking to a friend and saying, oh boy, is he a mess. I'm, you know, he wets his pants all the time and he's always crying for things and, you know, there's no excuse. And that child is absorbing those thoughts. He may not understand the words, but he's absorbing the thoughts. And as Bernard says, those words like that are believed to start the baby on a destructive course of life. I remember an uncle who was playing with the child, he kept calling him a speaker. And I know he did it jokingly, but I had everything I could do to control myself, to say, please, don't say that to him. So we do those things innocently, not meaning to ruin the child's life, and sometimes those words do. Bernard continues, personality is the sum total of one's physical, mental, emotional, and successful traits and habits, and includes one's past experiences, present conditions, and the possibilities of what one might become. It includes the views others take of all these things. Now I know you people have contributions to make, and I want to hear them. And I'm sure you have had experiences along these lines that could add much to our conversation here. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, the best way that we can make sure that our children do not submit to peer pressure is to build up their self-confidence and make them feel that they are the leader. I have a key phrase on that very thing. I have 21 daughters, so 15 now. And they were pretty stuck at school for obvious reasons. Because one was much more aggressive than the other. And they didn't want the other one to feel that she was any less because she wasn't as aggressive. So they put me in the two different schools. There wasn't any way to compare them. And this one, who was the less aggressive one, came home one day and said, you know, she named the kids from her friend, try and get me to cut class today. And I wanted to know. And they just begged me and begged me. And finally I just said, here, precious, here, precious, here, precious. And they said, well, what did you do? She said, they finally just laughed and left me alone. So this is quite a thing. Think about all you can do. I mean, here, precious, you really can get to a child who doesn't think much of himself. You know, we used to wonder about to smoke just because everybody else is smoking, or to take the drink because everybody else is. But if the whole time builds a kid's self-confidence, makes you feel that his values and his standards are as good as anybody's, then he's willing to stand by. And you're very lucky when some of the leaders on the campus who are popular have that kind of character, because they will withstand so-called peer pressure. And that's a very good point to make.
And then something else that you talked about, and that's, you know, the perfect parent or something, that since you have a daughter who's sick, that stay up to bed, and you make more baby of it, that something she's working through and has really improved, but obviously that's not quite the first 5 minutes. And so when you go to visit some people, and there's two families that we don't visit overnight, mm-hmm. because of that problem, and why would you be able to turn to go into a year child,
then holding him up to me as a role model, As somebody that I like to admire and I like to emulate, was really an effective tool. I didn't necessarily think so at the time, but looking back on it now, I can really identify that as one of the things that I think really helped me a whole lot in saying that, you know, if you can be like that, I can too. I guess I'm trying and hoping to still utilize that on my daughters in kind of the same way. Not necessarily that, you know, my dad or my mom would say, well, I did this, you know, that sort of generation gap, you know, that's old news, Mom.
No, yeah.
But, you know, these kids living the same time that I am, it's got the same kind of, pressure, if you will. And, you know, he's really done a good job with it, and maybe I can too.
That's a very good point. You're lucky if the oldest child in the family is a strong person, because quite often the older siblings set the pattern for the other children. And we had such a daughter as the oldest of three, and I remember people were asking her to babysit when she was hardly 12 years old. And so we talked about, you know, if other people had that much confidence in her, could we let her stay home with the other two younger ones? So we decided we would try it. And when we came home, they were all so enthusiastic about Diane being their babysitter. They said, oh, let us always have Diane as our babysitter. And I said, well, why? Why do you like having her better than anybody else? She's fair. She's so fair. And I felt at that time, they recognized this quality of fairness. And she's the example. And I think quite often the older one is that way. Mm-hmm. Have you found that?
I agree with the body. And I think I did the same thing when I was obviously before the 4 years of years. When my own family, my younger sister was born, and I was raised here.
Oh my.
But there's the other side of the coin too. But that child who is the example, then this attempt to be a child grows up too fast. And it wasn't until I got to Michigan and all of a sudden I was away from all this responsibility that I got to be free. Because I didn't have anybody to listen to me. Well, I knew I had so many little ones. Her first children were just a couple of years younger than she, and they were playing together. Yeah. We were 3 years and 2 years, so they were six to young.
Yeah.
And then we had a gap of 4 years and then a gap of
4 years. You can't overdo it.
And that was my experience.
Yeah.
It could
be.
I got to be myself, you know?
Yeah,
I understand.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question, and a very legitimate one.
I think about the academic part of it. When you put on paper and muscle, you're talking about forming fashion halls for Omaha. We have seen some of our old great writers in the 60s and we have something in there called problem solving or something like that, or we have something in the 60s. So this traveling other states and context, that sort of thing, does that help you? Anything else, Michael?
Well, of course, they tell us that we should live to our potential, you know, live up to our potential. But I think a lot depends on how those kids feel about it. You know, if they enjoy doing it, with our two young guys, one is very aggressive, the other one's just laid back. And they're second this way. The one is, you know, essentially the editor of the paper, and she's almost going for school office, and then decided, no, I'm not leaving. I can handle that. So he just didn't run. But she loves that kind of thing. And she would love academic contests and that sort of thing. She always takes the accelerated courses.
Mm-hmm.
Her sister takes parallel.
She said, "Why should I work that hard? I don't care if I'm not at the top." And she just doesn't have the drive. And I think this is the difference. Some children have drive in one direction or another. She's a runner. Yeah. She goes out for track and stuff like that. And we all have this poor kids. And we can impose our values as far as what things they are or right on them. I don't think. I don't think it's going to take those kids to be attenders if they enjoy doing it.
It's just that it seems like they're wanting them to think like adults when they're still only 12 years old.
I know.
But you mentioned being not being a kid. I look back to when I was 12. I didn't care enough about that. It was kind of like a Korean War and stuff. I didn't want to know about that. I want to play baseball and football. That was just funny. I don't know where you're comfortable with that line.
Yes, Dr. Bernie.
I'll just keep our grandparents from spoiling our grandchildren.
That's your privilege. That's your role. Boy, you can't, grandparents can't spoil their children with too much love, and that's all we ask. I mean, it just can't be done. That's my feeling. I'm guilty. I'm one of the guilty grandparents, but we don't see them that much. And when we have them with us, it just seems as though we can't tell them enough how much we enjoy them and appreciate them. And that's what children drive on, being enjoyed. And grandparents usually have the time to enjoy them, and they thrive on it. We always take our, we always have our grandsons come up here with us for a couple of weeks, so they're away from their parents. They live out on the East Coast, and sure, I enjoy them while they're here. Rudy buys them ice cream cones every night. But we know it's not going to last more than 2 weeks, you know. So when they go home, their parents have to deal with that. But I don't But at home, they have to earn their spending money. If they'd rather spend it for an ice cream cone rather than a toy, they're not going to. They're going to buy the thing that they've been saving up for. But I just don't think, I think it's wrong if grandparents live next door and keep feeding the kids stuff that's not good for them. That's wrong. I think we need to tune into the parents and find out what are your standards now and tell me the rules. But if they're far away and you just see them occasionally, I don't think it is fun. And it's so much fun to talk to them over the phone when they live a long way away. They're so happy to talk to you, and oh my Lord. And then, since we have the boys come out here, our two granddaughters, the twins, we usually go back and take them on a camping trip in our, and we have a little VW van, and let them decide where do they want to go spend that week. We just take them 4 weeks because I think they get bored if we took them any longer. The last year we took them to the canyon, and one of them carried her camera and took pictures of everything, and the other one was always ready to pose. She was a laid back one. She always had a subject, and she always crowd posed. Very interesting. We had some wonderful pictures. And it was real fun. We let them take a lot of the responsibilities, keeping the camper clean and doing some of these chores that goes along with camping. But the important thing is that you have them by themselves. Well, we do another thing on generations, and so I don't want to shoot my wad here. But that's a good point. And I think a lot depends on how often you see them.
Can I say your subject again?
Of course.
How do you determine how much responsibility to give children? I'm talking about 10 or 10 kids. You mentioned the 12-year-old babysitting. If other people have that much confidence in it, I hear it in peer pressure and adult peer pressure there too. But as you're seeing how much responsibility to give the children, how much to let them go on their own, do things on their own, shopping in the mall, you hear all the crime that can happen too.
Yeah.
How do you determine the difference to let them go?
It's all an individual thing. It depends on that child, how mature the child is. It all depends on what kind of a neighborhood you live in, how safe is it. I think no matter how safe it is, they should be made aware of the danger.
They have no fear.
Yeah.
That is, they have no fear.
Which is good.
I didn't want that. They're knowledgeable.
I think I go along with them on their...
They won't go that way.
Well,
yeah. I think I'm going to hold them back.
Yeah. Well, if you have to decide that. It's an individual thing.
Just for them, just kind of
do what you feel is best. If they show good common sense in the way they behave when you're along, then chances are they know how to behave, and they'll behave that way and then get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so I think it's pretty good. Chances they will. But children are different.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't treat them alive.
But public schools, no.